If you're listening to this episode of your weekly Constitutional as a podcast, well, then you might be anywhere at all listening. But if you're listening to the radio, then almost a very, very good chance that you are in your car driving someplace. And that's great. Pay attention. But we do like to have people listen to us on the radio. And if you're driving, and especially if you're going a long distance, you might do what I do, and that's keep an eye out for those historical markers along the side of the road. And if it's safe, I pull over frequently, and I'll stop, and I'll see what happened nearby. But if you're like me, you probably also assume something, and that is that these historical markers are accurate. Well, as our guest today will explain, maybe they aren't. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and our subject today is monumental mistakes.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
Jim Lowen is a professor, an author, a remarkably nice and interesting fellow who's been on this show several times. He's told us about his book, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, which discusses the causes of the Civil War. He's talked to us about his other book called Sundown Towns, which explored racial discrimination in a number of specific places around the United States. But strangely enough, the book that first brought Jim to my attention is one we've never discussed on the show, at least not up till today. It's a book called Lies Across America. And as the name suggests, it's about things that aren't exactly factual, things that exist all across our country, things like historical markers, historical sites, and lots of great big granite monuments. Jim has traveled all over this great land of ours, and he has looked at a number of these things, and he has noticed inaccuracies, some of them deliberate inaccuracies. And he insists that monuments tell us not just about the events that they supposedly describe, but they tell us just as much about the people who erected them.
Yes, not just historical markers, monuments, some museums, a fort or two, a ship or two. I guess in a way this book had its genesis in our family vacations. My dad would stop the car for every darn historical marker or monument because he thought it was good for us.
You're kidding me. That's exactly what it used to happen with my dad. We stopped at every marker on the side of the road.
Yes, all across the country there's this dad. Well, I think these dads thought they were doing us a service, but as I unfortunately found out while writing Lies Across America, the subtitle of which is What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong, often he was, and the sites still are, doing us a disservice, because a whole bunch of them are, in some cases, just silly, in other cases, just dead wrong, and in other cases, subtly wrong, in wrong that in ways that, shall we say, make us stupider after we've been there than before we stopped.
This is sounding kind of like those surveys I've seen about Fox News, saying that people who watch Fox News are less informed than if they hadn't watched any news at all. Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, I'm not going to put a political slant on this one,
right,
because these things are wrong from a variety of directions, shall we say. But yeah, let me give you one example. I took my son along. See, I'm just repeating the sins of the fathers. I took my son along some years ago when we visited Buchanan's home in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And by Buchanan, of course, I mean President James Buchanan, the sorry president just before Abe Lincoln. One of the many things that this home never mentions is why Abe Lincoln was called, as he ran for office, Honest Abe. Did you know?
I don't really know.
Called Honest Abe because of all the scandals in the Buchanan administration. But they're never mentioned in history textbooks, and they certainly aren't mentioned at his historic home. His historic home, which is a mansion, is called Wheatlands. It causes me to conclude that we all need to name our house, you know. but his is called Wheatlands, and it's very nice. And the first interesting thing, or in a way non-interesting thing, that happened when we went there, there were four of us on this tour, my son and me, and then this other hapless couple that happened to be there at 1 p.m. when we started our tour. The director of our tour, who was also the director of the House Museum itself, began by saying, well, now, we're not going to talk politics here. You're here to see the house. Well, that's not true at all. It's not the grandest house in Lancaster. We're there because it's the house of this president of the United States. You know, if it was the John Doe house, we wouldn't be touring it. Then we saw a 15-minute video or so, which was so apolitical that it really didn't even mention, I don't think, and if it did, it just barely mentioned, that Buchanan was a Democrat, and it certainly didn't explain what in the world that might have meant. And then we get toured around the house, and everybody is in awe of the wallpaper and the silverware and stuff like that. When we're entirely done, there's two things we haven't heard a thing about, and so I asked questions. The first question is about the shortest question I ever asked. It only had eight letters. I said, was he gay? The director says, absolutely not. And he takes all four of us back up the main staircase, the central staircase in the main hall. And there, up at the top of it, is an oval portrait of the woman who Buchanan got engaged to for a few months in his late 20s. And this portrait, which, by the way, he did not put there and he did not own, this portrait proves that he was not gay.
Because he didn't marry a woman?
Because he didn't marry her in his late 20s. Well, it turns out, I did some more research on this, and another historian, who's a gay historian, actually, sent me a bunch of research on it. It turns out that when she broke off the engagement with him, it was, as her girlfriend to whom she'd confided said, because he could not seem to show her proper affection. So this is just a flat-out lie. Well, it turns out that he was. Right. Or some people say you shouldn't use the term gay because that's only reserved for the 20th century. So, all right, was he homosexual?
Okay.
And it turns out he was. And indeed, in the book Lies Across America, I out Buchanan. I show letters by him that absolutely state that he was homosexual without using that word, but say I've gone in pursuit of several gentlemen, I've gone a wooing of several gentlemen, blah, blah, blah. So we're getting a straight lie at this historic site.
Let me clarify here, Jim, that when I'm laughing at what you're saying, I'm certainly not laughing at the idea that somebody was gay. I'm laughing at the apparent cover-up by the people who are running this house.
It's terrible. I mean, and my one-liner is that gay folks should have the same right to be a bad president that anybody else has. You know? And we're taking that right away from them by lying about it. And indeed, for some years, he kept house, if you will, with a senator from Alabama who was a slave owner and a member of the far-out pro-slavery wing of the Democratic Party. And Buchanan thought the world of him, and this undoubtedly influenced his politics. Well, the second thing I asked was, how was he on slavery? And I memorized the answer because it was so vivid and so astonishing. The man replied to me, he was against it. All the people in this area were. Well, he's right about the area. The area, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, is full of Amish and Mennonites, which are the first group to be against slavery in the Western world, and Quakers, who were the second group. And so it was against slavery, but not Buchanan. And indeed, it turns out that Buchanan's own church, the Presbyterian Church of Lancaster, disfellowshipped him, removed him from communion because of his far-out pro-slavery views. So we get two complete lies, and furthermore, as I've already indicated, the two lies are connected because it was undoubtedly his romantic attachment that helped fuel his pro-slavery commitment.
And that's such an important point, Jim, because this is not just idle curiosity. This is not just prurient interest. This is a very significant thing. If he was gay and if his lover was pro-slavery, then that affected his politics, probably.
His lover, incidentally, was William Rufus King, who was, as I mentioned, senator from Alabama and briefly vice president under Pierce, the Buchanan's predecessor. And both Pierce and of course, King were very pro-slavery. Buchanan's faction of the party had its own newspaper. I think Buchanan controlled it himself before and while he was president. And this newspaper in Washington, D.C., was so pro-slavery, it basically argued that the existing free states should allow slavery. that there's no, it's inexcusable under the under the Constitution, why people cannot bring their property, and by which they mean, you know, and they explicitly mean their property and human beings, into all states. Well, that's a far-out pro-slavery position that denies that there should even be such a thing as free states. That was Buchanan's position. So you end up then leaving Buchanan's house knowing less about Buchanan than when you started.
That is just remarkable. You know, that reminds me of an experience I had 20, 30 years ago, maybe 20 years ago at Monticello. I was there with an exchange student who was staying with us. She was from Zimbabwe, a black African girl. And as we went through the house, one of the other visitors, I didn't know this person, asked about slavery. And the tour guide answered very briefly. And then some other visitor said, yeah, but he was a good master.
Yeah.
And that sort of attitude that was, in that case, it was just another guest, suggests the sort of pressures that these historic sites are under, because people often don't want to hear about the bad stuff.
They often don't. I think we are changing. I'm writing a third book about how we remember the past. It's going to be called Surprises. Well, I should mention that my bestseller was Lies My Teacher Told Me,
yes.
Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. And it sold over 1.5 million copies. And then Lies Across America was a follow-up to that about historic sites. And it's done pretty well, too. And the third book's going to be called Surprises on the Land, Unexpected Places to Get History Right. And I think there's increasing pressure on that side. And I came upon a quote just this morning, for instance, from the president pro tem of the Senate of the state of Mississippi, which he said last fall, October or November, when they were breaking ground for two new museums simultaneously in Jackson, Mississippi. One is a new state history museum. They did have one, but it was it's a long story, but they've outgrown it. And so they're having a new one. And right next to it, they're having a separate Mississippi Civil Rights Movement museum. It's going to be a state museum about the Civil Rights Movement. And this guy said something like, now I'm going to do this from memory. I hadn't planned to quote him today, and I just read it this morning. But he says something like, and he's a white Republican, I might point out. He says, Mississippi history must be for every Mississippian. And it must include, in fact, it especially must include those things in Mississippi history that perhaps we wish had not happened.
Well, that is just remarkable and is to some extent unexpected. I'm going to also give kudos to the people who underwrite this show, the people at Montpelier, James Madison's home. I think if you were to visit there, you would find that they are taking the issue of slavery head on and are very, very forthcoming about it these days. So maybe there is a movement afoot that for more accuracy.
Well, certainly, I'm glad to hear this about Montpelier. When I went there, it wasn't so good, but that was a long time ago. Monticello has improved. They now state flatly that Thomas Jefferson did have sexual relations with Sally Hemings and did produce children by her. I've watched them change on this. They used to deny it. Then they said, well, maybe, we don't know. And now they're pretty much not just admitting it, but stating it openly. So that's an advance, too.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author James Loewen about his book, Lies Across America. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll continue our conversation with Jim Loewen. Stick around.
The work of Montpelier was done primarily by its permanent and integral staff of about 100 enslaved African Americans during James Madison's tenure as owner. Slaves served in a variety of roles, domestic servants in charge of cleaning, cooking, and care of clothing, and as artisans for the mill, forge, wheelwright, and other carpentry and woodworking. During the time that the Madisons owned the estate, 5, 6, and possibly 7 generations of African Americans were born into slavery at Montpelier. The most well-known slave from Montpelier was Paul Jennings, who was body servant to Madison from the age of 10, when he accompanied him to the White House, to the president's death in 1836. Born in 1799, Jennings was purchased from Dolly Madison and freed in 1845 by the Northern Senator Daniel Webster after Madison's death. Jennings continued to live in Washington, D.C., where he worked and became a property owner. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blalock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author James Loewen about his book Lies Across America, which critically examines so many of the factual inaccuracies at various historic sites, historic markers, historic monuments across the United States. And before the break, we were talking about one that you may have visited, Monticello. And James Loewen was explaining how, in days of yore, Monticello avoided the issue of slavery, but how it's facing up to it these days, how there's been really a marked improvement. Indeed, that sort of improvement has occurred at a number of these sites over the past few years, perhaps because of James Loewen's efforts. It's been a while since I've read your book, but I seem to recall there were a couple of other really good stories. Could you share a couple with us, one of the places that sort of shocked you when you visited them?
It's full of good stories.
Yes.
Just to name a silly one, there is a historical marker in the little town of Pittsburgh, Texas, that an official state historical marker put up by the Texas historical marker folks. And it says that the Wright brothers were not the first to invent the airplane. Rather, in 1902, a full year earlier, the Reverend Burrell Cannon invented an airplane in Pittsburgh, Texas, and it was briefly airborne here. And so he beat the Wright brothers. Well, I went there. I went to the only restaurant, I think, certainly the major restaurant in downtown metropolitan Pittsburgh, where they have a life-size mock-up of this airplane. And this airplane that he invented is powered by four vertically mounted paddle wheels. Now, paddle wheels work great on a river because there's a difference between water and not water. But in an airplane, they don't work so good. They pull down and they generate lift, and they pull to the rear and they generate forward movement. But then, oops, they pull back up and they ungenerate the lift, and then they pull back forward and they ungenerate the forward motion. In other words, they just spin their wheels. So it's clear just from looking at it that this aircraft was never airborne. But the state of Texas says absolutely it was. And so everybody across America who's learned the Wright brothers, I guess, has learned the wrong thing.
Well, what do we do to combat this? Apparently, there's already been progress made. I mean, other than you writing your book and going and speaking to people, what do we do to combat this sort of inaccuracy?
I think the very best thing to do is to put up a historical marker right next to the monument or marker that's wrong and explain why it's wrong and why it went up. And that's happened in a few places. For example, in San Francisco, there is a huge monument called the Pioneer Monument. It's in the number one downtown square, right in front of the library and almost in front of City Hall. And it shows a bunch of things, but one of the things it shows is a standing white man and a supine, that means lying down, right? A Native American. We see these things all across the country, but it's just white supremacists right there. So what did San Francisco do about it? Well, they actually moved it when they were rebuilding the library, but they put it right back up. But then they put a big historical marker next to it. And that historical marker, which was written with the help of Native Americans, basically says, we are not all gone. We still live here. There's over 100,000 of us in California, and gives their history after their near extermination during the gold rush. So that's pretty cool.
Well, that's actually very consistent with what you say about these historical markers in your book, and that is that they tell us as much or perhaps more about the people who erect them than about the original historical event. In fact, I'm reminded that the United Daughters of the Confederacy was a group that put up lots and lots of monuments in the early part of the 20th century, and you seem to think they had an agenda.
Oh, yes, and they're still putting them up even. I know of one they put up in Arkansas maybe 10 years ago. You can go all across the country, because, for instance, there's a historical marker. It's a monument. It is a fountain, a granite fountain, to our beloved Confederate dead, that was put up by the United Daughters of the Confederacy, as you mentioned, in Helena, Montana. You might think, you know, they're not only, I don't remember the Confederacy holding Montana. And for that matter, during the Civil War, the United States didn't even hold Montana. There was this guy named George Armstrong Custer that had a little Indian trouble in Montana some 15 years after the Civil War started. But that didn't stop the good ladies of the United Daughters of the Confederacy from putting up this monument for the Confederacy in about 1914, I think it was, right in the middle of what we call the nadir of race relations. That is, when the United States went more white supremacist in its thinking 1890 to 1940, than at any other time. And so you see these darn monuments all over the place where they are no more appropriate than they are in Montana. Can I give you one other example?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, the state of Kentucky, Abraham Lincoln is said to have said, and I think he did say, I would like to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky.
Yes, he did.
And what he means by that is he'd like to be right on slavery, but he's got to have Kentucky on his side geopolitically, or else he may lose the Civil War. Well, he did keep Kentucky on his side. Kentucky never seceded. And, of course, the Emancipation Proclamation does nothing and says nothing about slavery in Kentucky or any other part of the United States that didn't secede. Kentucky did send 35,000 troops to the Confederacy, but it sent 90,000 troops to the U.S. armies, and it never seceded. Today, Kentucky has 74 Civil War monuments. Two of them are for the United States, and 72 are for the Confederacy. So the Confederacy holds Kentucky, holds it on the ground. They got it between 1890 and 1940 during this terrible nadir of race relations.
That is remarkable. You know, I happen to, this radio station, WETS, is in Johnson City, Tennessee, which, as you know, is in northeast Tennessee. And this region was very pro-Union because there was very little slavery here. There were very few plantations here. It was pro-Union. And yet today, you see lots and lots of Confederate flags. I don't think that these neo-Confederates realized just how pro-Union an area this was.
It's terrible. There are even states, even counties, for instance, that seceded from the Confederacy because they were so pro-Union. One example is Winston County, Alabama. And Winston County proclaimed itself, I think, the Republic of Winston, and the Confederacy had to go in and occupy it by force. And damn if the Winston County hasn't gone Confederate after 1890, you know? So this whole freedom-loving past of much of Appalachia has been lost. And something else happened in much of this same area in Appalachia, and that is some of these very counties that didn't like secession, didn't like slavery. Also, after 1890, when they were pretty much forced politically to become Democrats or else not have anything to do with power in their states. I mean, you know, we had the one-party South from about 1890 until about 1960. And Kentucky pretty much too, and Tennessee for sure. So what these counties were kind of forced to do was invent a Confederate past in order to participate in the Democratic Party. And many of them went sundown, that is, including the county you're in, of course. And by going sundown, I mean they drove out their entire black population. Small as it was, so it could never have been a threat. You know, it's like 1% of the population. But they drove them out or pushed them out between 1890 and 1940, sometimes at the point of a gun. And many of them became white only, even posted signs saying, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Graham County or Mitchell County or whatever county we're talking about in North Carolina."
Yeah, we spoke about your book, Sundown Towns, when you documented that phenomenon. I just think it's just remarkable, the rewriting of history that's been going on for so long. Now, you've mentioned a couple of times this low point in race relations, this nadir after 1890 and into the early 20th century. Could you just talk a little bit about what caused that? Why, you know, people would think that, you know, logically things were worse for black people under slavery, and that race relations might have been worse under slavery than they would have been post-abolition. So could you explain that a bit?
Yeah, and I'm not actually trying to claim, and well, of course, it's not my term, but the historians who use it are not trying to claim that it was better to be a black person and enslaved in, say, 1858 than it was in, say, 1918 in the middle of the nadir. But what happened during the nadir is things systematically got worse. That is, race relations would be worse in 1895 than they were in 1890, worse again in 1900. And furthermore, the white ideology, the belief system of white folks, got more and more racist, worse than it ever was in slavery. I mean, I think it goes like this. Nobody, not even Mrs. Jefferson Davis, Verena Davis, in 1859 could convince herself that slavery is an equal opportunity system, you know? I mean, it just plain isn't. People are not allowed to get out of slavery except under very weird circumstances, like sometimes from sleeping with the master or sometimes from escaping. But it's very hard to get out. Once in a while from paying your way out, but that was very hard. It's just not an equal opportunity system. But in 1910, let's say, black folks are still on the bottom. They're still the janitors and the maids. They're not doing anything, shall we say, important in Pittsburgh, in South Carolina, and wherever you are across the United States. And they've been two generations out of slavery, so it must be their own damn fault. That was the thinking behind the Nader. So just that development was one part of why we had a Nader. But then there were some underlying causes, and I call those the three I's that undermined the relative equality that was percolating throughout the United States during Reconstruction and not just through the South. And the three I's were, first of all, Indian Wars. I mean, here we are claiming that we don't have racism, that the 14th and 15th Amendment means everybody can vote equally and everybody has equal rights, except those damn Indians. And we still are continuing our wars against the Indians. When we discover gold in Colorado, we just take it from the Utes. When we discover gold in the Dakotas, we take it from the Lakota people. So that's still going on. Well, that kind of undermines the idea of racial equality. The second I is imperialism. And, of course, we get into that from taking Hawaii. And Hawaii already has a government, but we just take it. And then we get involved in our war against the Philippines in 1899. And the Democrats, actually, to their credit, called the Republicans out on this. They said, how come you're attacking the Philippines? They already have a democracy. The leader of the United States in the Philippines at that time, our imposed general, says, our little brown brothers are not ready for democracy. And of course, this just caused the Democrats to say, well, then what about our little black brothers in Mississippi? You know, leave us alone. And so then the third I was immigrants. And immigrants messed up the idealism in the Republican Party in a couple of ways. But just to mention one of them, we have all these new European immigrants, let's say from Italy, from Greece, Jews, Russians, people from Poland, and they are voting Democratic once they become citizens. Why? Well, partly because the Republicans are moving towards prohibition, and you're not going to get the Italian vote by coming out against wine, you know. You're not going to get the Polish vote by coming out against beer. But also partly because the Democrats offer them racism, and so they help these immigrants to drive blacks out of jobs at the wharfs, for instance, or even jobs in being maids, and offer them jobs and then want their votes in reply. Well, the Republicans, instead of getting mad against the Democrats like they should have, wind up getting mad against the immigrants and start saying, this is where nativism comes from, and this leads to eugenics and the SAT and all kinds of things that say we're better than these WOGs, these WOPs, these nasty word for Jews, these Polacks, etc. So these three I's undermine the anti-racism that comes out of the Civil War and Reconstruction. And by 1890, it's pretty much undermined and things go from bad to worse.
Oh, you know, it's kind of funny. When I mention the nadir of race relations to my constitutional law classes, they look at me blankly and I have to go through an explanation that's not as good as the one you just gave, but is along the same lines. I'm just curious, has anyone actually erected a historic monument anywhere to the nadir of race relations? Is there any commemoration of that?
Almost nothing. And I think the reason is because basically our take on our history is we've been getting better all the time. And the nadir just doesn't fit with that. But there are a couple of places, and one in particular I'm going to mention in my new book, Surprises on the Land, and that is a statue of Jackie Robinson in North Florida. He played in the minor leagues. I thought he was mostly in Montreal, but apparently he was briefly in Florida as well. And so they have a statue of him, and in the plaque underneath it, they say very effectively and very clearly that he was not the first black player in the major leagues, which almost everybody thinks he was. He was the first black player in the major leagues after the Nader. They all got thrown out around 1890 from the majors and the minors. So that's one place where it is on the American landscape.
So American Major League Baseball or professional baseball was not always segregated.
That's right.
Now, see, you've just taught me something else I didn't know. I just figured it was segregated from the beginning.
Nope, just from 1890.
Just remarkable. Well, you mentioned North Florida, and of course that reminds me of the current controversy at the battlefield in Olustee, Florida. Olustee was the site of the biggest Civil War battle in Florida.
Right.
And my boys and I, when they were much younger back in the 1990s, went on a visit to Olustee. I think we wanted to watch a reenactment or something. And while we were there, we saw exactly what you described in your book. First of all, there was this huge granite monument erected by the United Daughters of the Confederacy, which basically misstated what happened there and made it all about hearth and home and you know, protecting the home against the invaders. And then you went into the visitor center, and they had a much more factual account of what had gone on that directly contradicted much of what was in the monument and even referenced that fact. So they were well on their way back in the 1990s, at least as far as the Park Service was concerned, in correcting the historical record. But the fact that they were ahead in that regard, of course, hasn't prevented a lot of people from protesting the current proposal to erect a monument to the Union soldiers who died there. And in fact, there were two or three times as many Union soldiers who died there as Confederates.
Yeah, and another part of that was that USCT, or United States Colored Troops, played a major part in that battle. They were what stopped it from becoming a rout, because they really protected the retreat. And one of the reasons they had to stop it from becoming a rout was because if it had become a rout and they had been captured, they knew that the very best thing that would happen to them would be re-enslavement, and it would also be possible that they would simply be massacred.
Yeah, actually, that was a very moving and very dramatic story that the guide told us all those years ago, was that as the Union was retreating, and it was typically considered a Union defeat. I mean, after they retreated back to near Jacksonville to their fort near the coast after this. And so as they were retreating, the black troops realized that their wounded black fellows would receive some pretty nasty treatment at the hands of the Confederates, who were known to kill or maim or re-enslave black Union soldiers. But the unfortunate thing was they'd arrived by train, and that for some reason the engine was no longer functioning. And so the story we heard at the battlefield was that they literally loaded their wounded comrades into freight cars, and then attached ropes to the train. And in the heat of summer, they pulled these train cars out of harm's way. And that was part of the retreat. And they were saving their comrades in this makeshift and very difficult way. I thought that was pretty dramatic.
Yeah. And they knew, of course, what had happened at Fort Pillow. In fact, often black troops went into battle shouting, "Remember Fort Pillow," which scared the bejesus out of the white Confederates opposing them, because what the white Confederates had done at Fort Pillow in western Tennessee, when they had taken black POWs and had come upon black wounded troops, was either kill them if they were wounded troops, to slay them all, or re-enslave them, both. Mostly kill them. And so they were remembering Fort Pillow when they pulled those freight cars.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author James Loewen about his award-winning book, Lies Across America, in which he examines many of the inaccuracies in our historical markers, historical sites across the nation. It turns out that some of those inaccuracies are intentional, and that one of the biggest offenders was a group called the United Daughters of the Confederacy. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with James Loewen, and then we'll speak with another guest, a fellow by the name of Brian Stevenson, who's going to update us on a current controversy in Montgomery, Alabama. Stay tuned. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now let's finish our conversation with James Loewen, author of Lies Across America. Which reminds me of yet another Jacksonville controversy, and I'm not sure if it's still going on, but back in the 90s when I was there, there was a great brouhaha over, you guessed it, Nathan Bedford Forrest High School.
Let's close with that story, because in fact, that story is a heartening one. 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks by now, they renamed that high school. It was a big controversy since the 1990s, as you point out. And it finally came to the head again this past fall. And in fact, my book, Lies Across America, played some role in this controversy, because in that book I have two different chapterettes, we might call them, about Nathan Bedford Forrest, both in Tennessee, pointing out some of the things he did. He did some astonishingly evil things, actually.
Well, tell us, what were those things? Because, I mean, he was
He presided over the, it was his unit, and he was even on site at times over the massacre that we just were discussing in western Tennessee. And he presided over at least one other massacre of surrendered black troops in north Mississippi. He also just did little things, like, for instance, in Tennessee, a Confederate captain, I think, brought up a USCT soldier, United States Colored Troop soldier, who had been captured after a small battle in central Tennessee, to meet Nathan Bedford Forrest. And Forrest asks him he probably used some terrible swear word, and if he was a captured slave. And he said, no, I'm a free man from Pennsylvania, and I'm the body servant to, and he named some United States captain. And Forrest was somehow enraged at this reply, and so he drew out his gun and just shot the man's head almost off and killed him right there on the horse. And the Confederate captain who brought him to see Forrest was so astounded by this that he got himself transferred out of Forrest's command immediately and never served under him again. Well, this is the kind of man that this high school in Jacksonville, Florida, was named for. And it has now become about 58% black. And, of course, I would argue it's even worse when you have white folks going to a high school named for Nathan Bedford Forrest, because at least black folks are not going to try to emulate him. But white folks may, in a sense, and they may think, well, it's the right thing to do, not blow off people's head because they happen to be black, but that he's an appropriate hero for white Southerners. Well, he is not. And the student body voted against the name, but I have to say it was mostly on racial lines. I'm very disappointed in the vote of the white students in Jacksonville. But in any case, the majority did finally rule, and the school board, just a month ago, by a 7-0 vote, I think it was, renamed the high school, and it's now something like West End High School or something like that, something completely innocuous.
Well, better than being named after a war criminal.
And they even have a policy now. They're not going to name no more schools after no more individuals, because you never can tell, you know, what you find out next or what those individuals might do next if they're even still alive. But West End is pretty safe.
All right. Well, Jim Lowen, author of Lies Across America and Lies My Teacher Told Me and Sundown Towns and the Neo-Confederate Reader. What's the name of your new book again, the one you're working on now?
Well, it's not a book yet, but it's going to be Surprises on the Land, Unexpected Places That Get History Right.
And when can we expect to see that one in print?
Oh, God. I can't talk about it because instead I'm just talking with you on the phone, and so I don't get anything done.
Well, Jim, we're going to let you get back to your word processor, and we'll try not to pressure you too much, but I'll tell you, there are lots of people, including me, waiting with bated breath to add your next volume to our bookshelf, so you get back and get cracking.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Wasn't that a great interview with Jim Lowen? I've had him on the show several times, and he's always great. But you may have wondered, why was I talking about a book that was actually published? I just checked the date on it. It was published back in 2000. That's kind of an old book. Well, the reason I had Jim on, other than the fact that he's always such a good guest, is that I was reminded of Lies Across America recently when I read about a controversy over historical markers in Montgomery, Alabama. And in the account of the story that I read, I noticed a name of a fellow I'd met before, a fellow by the name of Brian Stevenson. I met him some years ago when he spoke at the Appalachian School of Law. And so I gave him a call, and here's what he has to say. So Brian Stevenson, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I'm a lawyer, and I direct a nonprofit called the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. We're a nonprofit law office. We provide legal assistance to condemned people, incarcerated people, poor people. And our latest project is actually a project on race and poverty, which is not specific to the criminal justice system.
I imagine not. I believe I have one of your calendars on my wall. Do you all distribute calendars?
We do. And the calendar is part of the Race and Poverty program. I've been interested for many years in broadening the conversation about race in this country, deepening it. We so often talk about race in a very superficial way. We don't provide the topics and the issues that generate comments about race. We don't provide a historical context. And I think that's a real mistake. And so I've been interested in talking about the history of racial inequality, the history of racial injustice, the institutions that have shaped the lives of people of color in a more detailed and nuanced way, in hopes that it will influence the way we think about race and the questions that emerge from time to time that reflect racial division and racial conflict.
Well, we're all about knowing our constitutional history here, and we're now particularly exploring the subject of monuments or commemorative plaques or those roadside signs that you see everywhere commemorating this or that event. And I recently read in the newspaper that there is something going on in your home city there that involves such monuments and remembrances. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. It's a part of a project, again, aimed at broadening the conversation about race. With regard to African Americans in America, I believe there are four institutions that have dominated the lives of people of color, that have shaped the lives of people of color. And we're trying to concretize those institutional frames. And the first, of course, is slavery. Slavery in America was very different than slavery in other parts of the globe. Slavery in America was racialized. We didn't have a slavery system that was transient, that was what happened to people who were down on their luck, per se. We had a slavery system that was largely about race, and we created myths about people who are dark, about their humanity, about their qualities, their characteristics. We assigned them features that made the slavery seem more legitimate. And of course, the 13th Amendment didn't talk about these myths, didn't talk about these relationships. And as a result of that, you know, slavery really didn't end. It just evolved. We created new ways to create and sustain racial hierarchy when slavery was over. And we want to talk about these other institutions. For me, the second institution is the institution of terror. And terrorism defined the lives of African Americans between the end of Reconstruction until World War II. The lives of people of color were shaped by lynching and violence and the threat of violence. The third institution would, of course, be segregation, Jim Crow, apartheid, the use of the law to sustain these racial hierarchies, to create a racial difference and to legitimate racial difference. And I don't think we've really done a good job of talking about that era either. We're now in the 50th anniversary of a lot of the civil rights movement activities. And we tend to sway, you know, to kind of lean toward the celebratory, to highlighting the progress and the achievements. And we haven't really talked about the suffering, the anguish, the trauma, the day-to-day struggle of African Americans who were humiliated on a regular basis. I grew up in the rural South, and my parents wouldn't take me into town as a child because they didn't want me to see them being humiliated by any white person who passed along, and their powerlessness to deal with that. And then I'm actually persuaded that the fourth institution is actually mass incarceration, the way we have now created a system so destructive, so dominant in many communities of color, that the Bureau of Justice is reporting that one in three black babies born in 2001 will go to jail or prison, says something really powerful and disturbing. And so to kind of make this a more meaningful effort, we started in the first institution, in the slavery era. And we tried to just document the prevalence of slavery. We prepared a report, which is called Slavery in America. And we focused on the Montgomery slave trade, because if you come to Montgomery, Alabama, you'll find 59 Confederate monuments and memorials and markers. We have hundreds of streets and schools and buildings named after Confederate heroes and legends. And until we started this project, there was virtually nothing about slavery. And that just didn't make any sense to us, because Montgomery was one of the most prominent and conspicuous slave trading spaces in America, and particularly after 1840, when the steamboat could travel directly to Montgomery up the Alabama River, and when rail was introduced that connected Montgomery to the Upper South. We had tens of thousands of enslaved people coming to this city every day. They were usually chained and paraded up Commerce Street, which is where my office is, to the slave market, which is about 150 yards from my office, and nothing of that history was reflected in the geography, in the landscape. And we wanted to change that, and we sought permission to put up three markers that would document the Montgomery slave trade, the portal where enslaved people came, boat, and rail, the warehouses that were lined all across the street where I work, the market, and then the depots where these enslaved people would be held. And that was the idea behind the project.
Well, what was the reaction?
Well, it was really disappointing, to be honest. We went to the Alabama Historic Commission, which is the entity that sponsors most historical markers. They put up dozens. There was a marker that was just erected about a year ago to commemorate and mark the first post office of the Confederacy. It was only open for about 4 months, but the commission felt it important enough to create a marker for that. And we went to them and we gave them the historical research we had prepared, and they reviewed it and concluded that all of the facts we were asserting were accurate. They didn't have any question or issues with the accuracy of what we were reporting, but then told us that they would not sponsor the markers because they believed that these kinds of markers, markers on slavery, would be, quote, too controversial. And as a result of that, we could not get their support in putting these markers up. We found a Black Heritage Council, which had some authority to sponsor a marker, but unlike the other markers, we were required to persuade city officials to allow us to put these markers up. And it was a long and somewhat complicated process. We ultimately did get permission to get them up, but not without a lot of controversy and not without the lack of support, or you could even say opposition, of the historical agencies empowered to do this kind of work in Central Alabama.
That is simply remarkable. So let me just be clear on this. All of your research was accurate.
Yes.
These were extremely important historical events that, that in fact precipitated the Civil War, which is itself heavily commemorated. And
yes.
Yet that was deemed to be too controversial to document or to display anything about.
It's really astonishing. I mean, we are a state that celebrates the Confederacy. We romanticize it. We glorify it. Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday in Alabama. Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday. We don't have Martin Luther King Day in Alabama. It's Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. And we are not shy at all about acknowledging, celebrating, glorifying the legacy of the Confederacy. So it's not that we don't like talking about mid-19th century history, but somehow talking about slavery is too controversial. And it is very puzzling. This community is 50% African American, and the black people in Montgomery are not recent immigrants. We are all the descendants of enslaved people. And that institution, which has had such a profound impact on this state and on our history and even many of the issues that we're dealing with, it was the 1901 Constitution, which is still the law in Alabama, that was the effort of white landowners to replicate slavery in Alabama. It was the segregation laws that was a response to the legacy created by slavery. The whole civil rights movement was a movement that grew out of the institution of slavery and what it did to relations between blacks and whites in this region, and that we would be unwilling or hesitant to recognize that history, I think says something really disturbing about where we are when it comes to race relations in this country.
Oh dear, well I'm not going to contradict you on that, Brian, but just give me an update though. Have the markers gone up?
They have gone up.
Has there been any reaction to them? Has there been any controversy?
We've gotten, you know, some unhappy calls, and we've gotten some unhappy emails. But so far, you know, they're still there. They haven't been vandalized. We check that every day. We did a race roundtable last week. We're actually using our building to tell stories about the slavery experience. And we've now distributed, you know, several thousand copies of the report, and the demand for the report has gone up after the markers were placed in the ground. And we're hoping to expand the marker project and work in other communities where we can help communities recognize and reflect on the historical experience of slavery.
It is just astonishing to someone in my business because, of course, as you know, you're a lawyer and you've studied the Constitution. This is perhaps the single biggest issue in our constitutional history. It's our original constitutional sin. And you cannot discuss this period in history without discussing slavery. It's the basis for the conflict.
That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the challenges when you don't talk about it is that all of these narratives emerge, like, well, it wasn't that bad, and it was good for black people to be enslaved, and all of these aspects of slavery get distorted. And so one of the things we're interested in doing with the report, and the reason why we're talking about it in this way, is that we want people in the region to know just how devastating and traumatizing the institution of slavery was. We want them to appreciate that people of color were burdened with a whole range of challenges and problems as a result of enslavement. And we are, in many places, still recovering from that. If you walk up Commerce Street today, I think there is a shadow on the street where the tens of thousands of people paraded up the street in chains. I think you can sense things that you cannot avoid sensing once you know what these buildings were used for. My office is actually on a plot of land that held a slave warehouse throughout most of the middle of the 19th century. And it changes your relationship to this space. It makes you, I think, more reflective of the challenges that we face on a lot of issues today when you appreciate how massive and devastating and dominant the institution of slavery was.
Well, the truth always changes one's perspective, and we're in favor of the truth here. And clearly, we're going to have to talk about this some more sometime, Brian, but right now we're running out of time. You've mentioned this report a couple of times. How can people find it online?
Sure. Well, if you go to our website, which is www.eji.org, you can get the short version of the report right online, and it will give you an overview of Montgomery and where the markers are and the content of the report. And for people who are really interested, they can email us, and we'll actually send you the longer version of the report at no cost.
What's your email address, Brian?
You can contact us at contactus@eji.org.
eji@.org.
Actually, it's contactus@eji.org.
Ah, okay. All one word, contact us.
Yes.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to Jim Lowen, author of Lies Across America and lots of other great books. Google him and buy some of his books. They're all great. Thanks also to Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative for bringing us up to date on yet another monumental controversy. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. My name is Stuart Harris. And oh yes, our theme song is done by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Thanks, guys. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.